Today, freedom of religion.
The church has exerted its power through politics in Australia since the very beginnings of white settlement. It's not so much that they fight for change. They're defending the boundaries. They're defending the slow pushback over time of a secular state that no longer sees why its laws should express, particularly express, Christian doctrine.
In late 2017, Australia voted yes to giving LGBTQI Australians the right to marry. Within a week, the government had also promised to look at the rights of religious groups, launching the Religious Freedom Review. Earlier this year, the government released a draft bill on religious freedoms. It's been hugely controversial, and critics say instead of protecting vulnerable groups, it could act as a license for hate. Now, in the coming months, the Australian Parliament will vote on it. So, what exactly is in this bill? And do religious groups need more protections and more rights under the law? I'm Laura Murphy-Oates, and this is The Full Story.
I think the recent religious freedom controversy can be traced back to the postal vote on marriage equality.
Paul Karp is a political reporter at The Guardian.
The plebiscite was originally cooked up by Tony Abbott as the last hurdle to try and avoid legalising same-sex marriage.
It's important to understand how ultra-conservatives, who have essentially very, very little public support, work to prevent change.
David Marr is a senior writer at The Guardian.
And they do so by stacking branches, getting pre-selections, getting into the party room, particularly of the Liberal Party, but also for a long time of the Labor Party as well, and making sure nothing comes to a vote. It's stopping the vote that is the way factions in politics, who might not command more than 20 or 25% of popular support, can keep things their way. They can prevent the future. A handful of members of the coalition party room, closely allied to the churches, prevented equal marriage happening in Australia for years. Until the situation became, as I like to think of it, as silly. A point comes in politics when something is just so silly that it badly affects the prospects of the government. And the government of Malcolm Turnbull and even some of its most conservative lieutenants, like Matthias Cormann and Peter Dutton, understood that the marriage issue had to be settled before the 2019 elections. They found a way of putting it to a vote. They found a way of sidestepping the factions in their own party that had managed to stop action for many years.
What a day. What a day for love, for equality, for respect.
So the plebiscite passes. How is that received by religious groups and by conservatives in the coalition?
They didn't much like the result, but the issue was off the table. But they had double-crossed the conservative ultras in their own party. You can't do that without offering a consolation prize of some kind. And a review of the state of religious liberty in Australia was that consolation prize, and it was given to the former Attorney General Philip Ruddock to run. And he was seen by the most conservative elements in the coalition as a safe pair of hands to do the job. It was actually, tactically, brilliant politics.
And that has become known as the Ruddock Review. What is that?
Philip Ruddock was given the task of assessing the state of religious liberty in Australia, assessing any threats to it, and making recommendations about how those threats might be met. Worked away for some months and delivered a report to the Turnbull government in May of 2018. And there it sat. We all asked, where is it? Can we see it? What's happening? Nothing, nothing, nothing. And it was still sitting there when Turnbull was sacked.
A few weeks after Scott Morrison became Prime Minister in mid-2018, the Ruddock Review, which no one had seen until then, was leaked. It's especially the recommendations at the top of it were leaked.
All that was leaked at first, and how could it have been leaked? I mean, there it was. It had been on Malcolm Turnbull's desk for months and months and months. And then Malcolm Turnbull is sacked as Prime Minister. And then in the context of the by-election for Malcolm Turnbull's old seat, there's suddenly a leak of these devastating small chunks of the Ruddock report that showed the public, firstly, that teachers can be sacked for being gay in private schools everywhere in the country except Tasmania. And what's more, in most states and territories in Australia, children can be expelled for being gay. Now, that struck a chord of disgust across the country. And suddenly, this complicated hidden issue of privileged exemptions from anti-discrimination laws moved from the edges of politics to the centre, at least for a time.
Recommendation 5 of the Ruddock Review calls for the government to tighten the Sex Discrimination Act so that religious schools can discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation, provided it's within the precepts of the religion.
The troubling loophole might have continued to go unnoticed.
What was reported today is existing law. Existing law.
Okay, so the Ruddock Review that was meant to investigate whether discrimination was occurring against religious groups actually found discrimination against kind of kids and minority groups by those religious groups. Is that right?
Well, not exactly. It did find that there was some religious discrimination, but it also noted that religious institutions have exemptions from discrimination law that allow them to discriminate against LGBT staff and students, for example. And by recommending that that be entrenched, it really put up in lights that that was a power that they had, and that was the thing that took hold in the public, you know, concern.
So when the report actually came out, did it suggest that these powers, you know, the ability to expel LGBTQI kids from schools, should be changed?
Well, it said that religious schools should have both hiring and firing power over teachers and also the ability to expel students, including LGBT students, even if that was discriminatory. But they just suggested a few safeguards, such as that the school had to give notice that that was their policy and consider the best interests of the child.
And did anything actually happen with that? Was there any action on that in the end?
Labor wanted to end the situation for kids instantly. They wanted to end it, but Morrison wouldn't have it.
My understanding of my faith and other religious teachings goes to people's behaviour, not who they are.
He talked to the churches. He still wanted punishments of a kind to be able to be imposed on gay and transgender kids in schools.
The proposal that the coalition had to remove this ability to expel gay students, Labor thought was even worse than the status quo.
I can't turn my back on credible legal advice that the government's proposals will replace one form of discrimination with another.
Because although it dealt with expulsion, it didn't deal with, you know, having other discriminatory rules. You know, you could make gay kids write lines saying that, you know, homosexuality is a sin and that they're going to hell, but not expel them. And eventually they decided that wasn't much of an improvement.
Okay, so other than these revelations, what were the other big recommendations that came out of this Ruddock Review?
Well, the main recommendation was that people shouldn't be able to discriminate based on others' religion and to give religion equal status with other protected attributes like sex and race in discrimination law by protecting them on that basis.
So with the Ruddock Review out in 2019, who is in charge of taking these suggestions and turning it into legislation?
Christian Porter, the Attorney General under both Malcolm Turnbull and Scott Morrison in 2018, it was his job to turn the Ruddock Review into a workable religious discrimination bill. And at first, Morrison and Porter promised that we'd see that legislation before the election and they'd even try and pass it before then. But that was a commitment that they didn't meet.
I would be curious to hear from Paul is why it took them so long to draft. Why was it such a tricky... I think I know why it was such a tricky exercise, but who inside the government was pushing back on this exercise? Is that why it was delayed so long, Paul?
Yeah, so I think the reason they had to delay is that the public stated intention was just to have a vanilla anti-discrimination bill, but conservatives like George Christensen, Concetta Fierravanti-Wells, Barnaby Joyce, they wanted it to do a lot more than that.
What did they want the bill to do?
Religious conservatives want a positive ability to discriminate, which they describe as a positive religious freedom. Instead of having exemptions from discrimination law, they want a positive right to discriminate. And that's essentially the distinction between a religious freedom bill and a religious discrimination bill. A religious discrimination bill prevents others discriminating against you on the basis of religion, and a religious freedom bill gives people the right to put into practice their beliefs, even if that involves things like, you know, not treating people or hiring and firing people based on, you know, sex or marital status.
So there's been a lot of delay on the bill. Finally, it comes out. What does it say?
Well, Christian Porter the whole time had been promising a vanilla religious discrimination bill. At its base, that's what the bill did. But stacked on top of that were a number of bolt-ons to try and fix concerns that religious conservatives had. It creates a new religious freedom commissioner in the Australian Human Rights Commission, which is not something that Philip Ruddock recommended. It overrides Commonwealth, state and territory discrimination laws. It has a Israel Folau clause. There's a clause that allows medical practitioners to refuse to treat people on the grounds of religion.
So this sounds like an extraordinary amount of change, and like it could change a lot of the ways in which our society operates currently. Is that right?
But that's always the way these things work. The people pushing for maximum legal protection for religious belief and religious practice are always pushing the edges, always trying to make things broader. It is remarkable when you think about it, the amount of help religions demand from the law.
Next, how this bill could change Australia. So what has been the reaction to the draft of this bill?
So there was a reasonably quick consultation over a little over a month, and it got more than 6,000 submissions, and a lot of groups weren't happy with the bill. You had human rights and LGBTI groups who disliked it because it provides a sword and not just a shield against discrimination. Employers were concerned about the Israel Folau clause interfering with their ability to set codes of conduct in their workplace. And even religious conservatives had issues with it because the exemption that allows religions to discriminate on the basis of religion did not extend to their commercial service providers, things like aged care, hospitals and youth camps. So even they wanted the bills to do more.
Yeah, you mentioned that Folau clause. Can you unpack that a bit more? Like, how? What does this mean and how would it work?
Yeah, so Israel Folau was sacked by Rugby Australia and the Wallabies for saying that gays were going to hell, which he said wasn't discriminatory because it was just an expression of his faith. So what the Israel Folau clause does is says that employers can't set rules that indirectly discriminate against employees, for example, by controlling and preventing them expressing their religious beliefs outside work.
Mm.
So if they're against same-sex marriage because of the tenets of their religion, then they get that protection. But in terms of what people who lack faith can say, it has to be directly related to their lack of faith. So you could say, you know, there is no God, but you couldn't campaign by saying political things like I'm in favour of same-sex marriage, because being in favour of same-sex marriage isn't necessarily something that follows from, you know, your lack of faith.
Can you imagine, Paul, the scene in the High Court when this is being argued? I mean, it's Gilbert and Sullivan. It's a completely absurd situation. It's all about threat. It's what you can do by threatening people with the ultimate sanction of the law. And it's vague and it's tough and it's threatening. But the notion of it ending up one day in the High Court where an atheist faces off against, say, the Catholic Church over the right to free speech is bizarre, because the principle is not speak your mind and keep your job. The principle is let religions decide who, having spoken their mind, can keep their jobs. That's the important point. This is not actually about the freedom to speak your religion. And in my view, people should be as free as possible to speak their religion and keep their jobs. This is about individual religions having the power to decide who will be employed and who others must employ because they express religious views that that particular religion supports. If they don't support the view, they're not going to help.
So it puts power in the institutions rather than the people necessarily.
This is all about power for the institutions.
So the other point I want to come back to is this bill proposes to override, you know, anti-discrimination laws that already exist. How is that going to work? How is that clash going to play out?
So under this bill, statements of religious belief are exempt from other federal, state and territory anti-discrimination laws. So no longer would prohibitions on offending, insulting and humiliating people, which is in Federal Racial Discrimination Act, those would no longer apply to statements of religious belief. So you could tell people that, you know, their disability that is a mark of being possessed by the devil. You could tell single mothers that's immoral. And they can't be sued under those discrimination laws unless they go a step further and they say it with malicious intent.
It just licenses more vicious speech by religions about others and by one religion about another. And in particular, what it releases absolutely explicitly is the right of religious people to humiliate other people. That will no longer have protection of law. The religious will be free to humiliate.
The final thing I want to touch on is the fact that medical practitioners can refuse to treat people on the basis of religion. How would that work?
The bill prevents state governments forcing medical practitioners to treat people or to refer people. And as a result, medical practitioners will be able to discriminate on the grounds of religion, refusing to treat people based on the religion of the patient and refusing even to refer them to other services. You can see how that has applications with things like the morning after pill, but the range of medical services that can be refused is, you know, a podiatrist could tell you that they're not going to treat you because you're Muslim, Jewish, Christian, whatever.
Okay, so it sounds like this bill does have some legitimate criticism. How has the government responded to this criticism?
Well, I think Christian Porter wants to pretend that because religion and human rights groups and LGBT groups are unhappy with it, that he's, you know, must have done a brilliant job of splitting the middle.
It's a balancing exercise. And the idea that everyone's going to be sort of marching in the streets with placards congratulating the government on the bill, I think, is not where we're going to end up. But that doesn't mean that there won't be a passage and a pathway through Parliament.
But I think we should all leave a bit of space for the possibility that it's just bad and that's why everyone hates it. The only amendment that Christian Porter has suggested he's going to make before introducing the bill into Parliament is to address religious institutions' concerns that their commercial bodies, like hospitals and aged care and youth camps, aren't given an exemption to discriminate on the grounds of religion.
Religious and faith groups are generally pleased with the protection that having religion as an attribute would offer, but they probably go further in giving themselves greater autonomy around employment of staff.
The bill at the moment makes an important distinction about what faiths can do on the non-profit and the profit side of their operations. So this new right to advantage people in church organisations because of their faith is not available, as the bill now stands, in the commercial side of faith operations. So it's not available in hospitals. It's not available in nursing homes that take public money. It's not available. It's not available where cash is coming in from the public. The churches have denounced this. They want this distinction gone. And the impact of that would be, if Porter agrees to getting rid of that distinction, the impact of that would be that church-run medical organisations like hospitals would be able to hire, promote and fire medical staff according to their faith.
So despite a lot of submissions that were critical of the bill, Christian Porter's making one amendment, and that amendment is actually strengthening the protections for religious bodies.
That's the only thing that they've signalled that they're willing to do so far.
Now, that is, if it comes about, a truly remarkable situation in this country in this century. In the UK, if the faiths take public money, they can't discriminate. And that fate is what the churches in Australia are really scared of. If you say it is essential for us to maintain the ethos of the working place in, say, a school or a charity or a hospital, that we have the right not to engage homosexuals or lesbians, or we have the right to fire someone who transitions, then the UK government says, well, no more money from us. You can raise your own money. You can turn to your followers for the funds you need to run that hospital or that charity or that school, but you're not going to get public money. That choice between faith and funds deeply scares the churches in Australia because they use the workplace to enforce church rules of sex and life. That's what they see as one of the reasons they're in the game. They don't want to be forced into the UK position, which, by the way, operates in Tasmania and has operated in Tasmania now for many, many years. In Tasmania, you cannot discriminate against gays and lesbians and single mothers and et cetera, everybody on that list. You can't do it if you're a faith employer. And oddly enough, the work of Christ appears still to be successfully achieved in Tasmania in schools and hospitals and charities.
Okay, so how much support has this bill got in Parliament? How likely is it that it would pass?
So Labor, because they're so traumatised by losing the federal election unexpectedly, are quite paralysed, where some in Labor right are internally suggesting that they might have to pass this as a way to make peace with religious voters. But people in Labor left like Penny Wong and Tanya Plibersek have been very critical, particularly of the fact that it overrides other discrimination laws. So they haven't got a concrete position yet. Mm. The crossbench are very sceptical. Rex Patrick from Centre Alliance has said he's not sure there's been a demonstrated need for the bill yet. And Jackie Lambie has said similar because she's noticed.
I know that the religious freedoms that we have in Tasmania, which are as they are now, they're working pretty well, and I don't have a lot of
Tasmania already has religion as one of the things that people are protected on the basis of.
Tasmanians seem to be pretty satisfied with that, so I'll have to take that on that, you know, they don't really want this changed.
So she sees, you know, only possibility to go backwards by supporting a federal bill.
When will this bill go before Parliament?
Well, Christian Porter has said he'll introduce it before the end of the year, but he has missed deadlines before, so we're not completely certain that's
those
what they're aiming
those
for.
Those promises haven't been particularly binding in the past.
No, exactly.
Okay, so we're going to see this play out in the coming weeks and months, but it's been incredibly contentious. I suppose the question that Lambie has asked and that other people have asked is, do we need this bill?
Well, there are those who say it's essential to the survival of faith in Australia, and without this legislation, God's work can't be done in this country as it should be done, which, of course, is the usual kind of apocalyptic spiel that you get from faiths. Mm-hmm. There are other religious, deeply religious people that I've spoken to about this bill who are embarrassed by it, are embarrassed by the prospect of faiths being privileged in this way. And there are those who say simply and bluntly, it is not needed. We didn't need it in the past. We don't need it now. There are some issues around the free speech of employees. There is no doubt about that in my mind. But this is an extraordinarily cumbersome way of going about dealing with them.
I think both sides of politics agree that, you know, shops shouldn't be able to refuse to serve someone because they're Muslim or because they're Jewish or because they're part of any other faith. But the problem is that the bill does so much more than that. And it's all those nasty bolt-ons like giving doctors the ability to refuse to treat people on the basis of their religion and overriding other discrimination laws. If the bill were just a religious discrimination bill, it would sail through Parliament. But with all the bolt-ons, I think it's very hard to make the argument that we need those things.
That's it for today. If you like this episode, don't forget to subscribe to the show. Just search for Full Story on whatever app you get your podcasts on. We would also love to hear what you think about it so far. So if you're on an app that has ratings and reviews, please give it a go. Special thanks to Paul Karp and David Marr for their time. You can read their reporting on this at theguardian.com. This episode was produced by Ellen Lee Beater and executive produced by Miles Martignoni and Gabrielle Jackson. Okay, catch you on Wednesday.